Let's get started today. So welcome to our latest Employment Law 101 session. I'm Peter from MPM Legal, joined today by my colleague Adrienne. Morning, Adrienne.
Morning.
For those of you that don't know us, we're a specialist employment and business immigration practice. We're based in the south of England, but we've got clients all over the UK and indeed globally. They've all got a common interest, which is employing people here in the UK. We are running this series of Employment Law 101 webinars where we're taking you through the life cycle of the employment relationship and talking about just some of the employment law considerations associated with that. We are recording today's session, as we do with all of our webinars, and you can find a link to the past video recordings on our website, and you can also now find a link to our audio recordings on Spotify, which is rather exciting. So if you want to listen to the audio track when you're driving, jogging, working, or ironing, or whatever it is you do when you're listening to podcasts and things, then check us out on there. Today's session is all about restrictive covenants and restrictions, but at the recruitment end of the process. Now, we're expecting some questions in relation to this session. We will do our best to get through them. These sessions are bite-sized ones, so we'll be about 20, 25 minutes. We'll try and make some time for questions at the end. If you'd like to ask a question, please use the Q&A function at the bottom of the screen rather than the chat function, because that just helps us manage the questions a little bit better. We're not going to turn anybody's camera or microphone on, so don't worry about that. We're not going to call you out if you ask a question either, but please do come to us with any questions as we go. So last week, for those of you that joined us, you'll remember that we were looking at the recruitment process, and in particular pre-employment checks, so DBS checks and immigration checks. Today is another phase of that, and that is the issue of restrictions and the type of restrictions that an employee who's looking to join you may have with their outgoing employer. So what are we talking about primarily? Well, usually it's things like a non-compete restriction, where somebody cannot join a competitor company for a period of time, or a restriction on the non-solicitation of customers, for example. And that would be where an individual is restricted from being able to go and approach customers or clients that they've been working with their outgoing employer for a period of time as well. Now, normally these restrictions last for a specified period of months, and that clock starts running from the date that their employment ends, so the last day of their employment with their former employer. So you might be thinking, why is this important for us as the new employer? And if you are thinking that, Adrienne's going to tell us the answer.
Well, I'm hopefully going to tell you the answer. Well, I mean, obviously it's going to impact on the candidate because it's going to restrict where they can go next. But it's also really important that you as the potential employer have your eyes on this, because you can get drawn in to any legal action that a former employer might take against their ex-employee. So very often you might see that the employee gets a snotty letter saying, we understand you're going to company X, they're one of our competitors, you need to stop doing that, or et cetera, or we're going to go for an injunction or sue you. Sometimes, and not all the time, but sometimes you will get a parallel letter as the new employer saying, oh, we understand you're now employing our ex-employee. Were you aware of their restrictions? They can't actually come and work with you for 6 months. And if you don't stop employing them, or you don't do what we ask you to do, then we'll join you in on any legal action. And clearly that's not ideal. That's not ideal for the candidate who's starting their employment with you. And it's not ideal for you who wants to take somebody on to hit the ground running. So it's really important that, as I said, that you do have your eyes on this, because there are a number of claims that legal action can face. Can look like. For example, they can say, well, were you aware that they had restrictions? Did you say, we don't really care about their restrictions, we're going to take them on anyway? In which case, that's a potential inducement to breach argument. In other words, you carried on regardless, you said, come to us anyway, we know you've got restrictions, we are actively encouraging you essentially to breach the contract. I mean, there are other claims as well, aren't there, Peter?
They are rarer, but there's a claim of causing loss by unlawful means, and there's a claim of conspiracy as well, which sounds very old-fashioned and like something out of the gunpowder plot. But those two claims kind of they're associated with you having induced an individual to breach a contractual obligation that they owe to somebody else. So yeah, there are three possible claims that you could face as the incoming employer, but the main one that we tend to see is inducement of a breach of contract.
Yeah, and what that basically means then is you have to, if you're on the receiving end of one of those stroppy letters, first of all, you're looking at whether or not there actually has been a breach, and we're talking breach of contract, so we'll need to know what the contract says. Then it's a question of, did you intend to breach it? Did you even look at the contract? Was the employee required to disclose to you any restrictions they had? Because sometimes you see that in restrictions, don't you? You see a clause in it which says, if you go to a competitor within this period of restriction, you must show them this part of the contract. Because the former employer wants to make sure that you are potentially on the hook as the new employer, and that therefore they might have that right of redress against you. So, in terms of what you can do, I think it's really important to make sure that you build into your recruitment process a reminder to ask the question. So you can ask the question directly of the candidate, are there any restrictions in your contract that we need to know about? And to be honest, you'll probably know this. You'll know that if you're reaching out to recruit people from your main competitor, they ring alarm bells for you, particularly for certain roles, which we'll come on to towards the end. But, it's a question, and don't forget to ask that question of the candidate. If you can, get a copy of their restrictions in the contract of employment and have a conversation with them. So, I think it's always better to be prepared so you can see these issues up front. I mean, there's a couple of reasons why you might want to do that. If you find out at an early stage that they are working for your main competitor, and let's face it, you probably know that from their LinkedIn profile, it's better to know what approach you're going to have to them before you get some way down that recruitment process, because it takes time to recruit somebody, and you don't want to go all the way down the line to find out, actually, do you know what, we're not up for this. We know that their ex-employer is super aggressive. We don't want to get involved in this. And you might decide to pull back. Likewise, when we talked last week about finding out about right to work checks, the more you are prepared up front, the better your more streamlined and successful your recruitment process is going to be. So, I think that's really important. But I think one of the things you've got to watch out for is making sure that when you are asking these questions of the employee, that you don't inadvertently ask them for more information than you actually need, because there's a really fine line, isn't there, Peter, in terms of what you can ask for and how you might land yourself in hot water by getting confidential information from their ex-employer.
Yeah, because what you're potentially trying to scope out is that you're not going to be inducing someone to breach a post-termination restriction in joining you. So what you're trying to avoid is a scenario where the employee has a restriction in their contract with their outgoing employer that says you cannot join a competitor for 6 months, for example. And let's say your business is a competitor business. What you're trying to avoid is a scenario where the outgoing employer can come after you and say, you're aware of this restriction, or you're aware of it now, you've got to stop employing this person, and or you've induced them to breach the contract and the contractual obligations contained in it that they owe us. Now, if when you're making an assessment of what the outgoing employment contract says, in making that assessment, you're trying to weigh up how enforceable those restrictions are, you are encouraging the outgoing employee to give you more commercial information about that business so you can weigh up how enforceable the restrictions are. You might inadvertently be encouraging them to breach other contractual obligations that are due. So like Adrienne said, you might be encouraging them to give away confidential information or business secrets. Now, you might not have the mindset of, well, they're giving us that because we're trying to poach that information or get hold of those secrets. It might be legitimately to try and weigh up the enforceability of the post-termination restrictions, but you're then going to be fighting a battle on two fronts, not one. So it's kind of compounding the problem, really.
Yeah. I was just going to say, we can talk a little bit about enforceability, can't we? Because, you know, this is sort of like a big thing. There's a lot of people that go, oh, well, they're never enforceable anyway.
I mean, that's definitely, you know, if I had £1 for every time that I'd heard somebody say post-termination restrictions are not enforceable anywhere, yeah, I wouldn't have a small fortune. I'd probably have £500. But I've heard it an awful lot. It happens all the time, and actually it's simply not true. Like, well-drafted post-termination restrictions absolutely are enforceable. If they're used in the right way, they are a really useful tool. So, I mean, obviously in this series, we're going to come on and look at contract formation and how post-termination restrictions may be useful for you in terms of your own employment contracts. But you do need to be aware that they are enforceable, which means you shouldn't just be ignoring them. So if somebody comes to you and they're saying, look, I've got these restrictions in my contract, you are on dangerous ground just to take the approach of, oh, well, we're indifferent to it, or we're not going to do anything and we'll just see what happens, because there is a chance that they could be enforced. And, you know, Adrienne, of course, you've got very real experience of the enforceability of restrictions because of the case that you were involved in last year.
Yeah, back end of last year. Yeah, we successfully secured an injunction for a company that in exactly that situation. Mm. I mean, it's an awful lot of justification to make sure that they're enforced. And again, we'll come on to that in a later series. But yeah, that I've got firsthand experience of saying, yeah, absolutely enforceable. But I think we're also kind of missing a little bit of the point, because it's not just the risk of them being enforced and legal action and all that sort of serious stuff. Injunctions, it's the fact that you're going to get drawn in to a load of back, you know, toing and froing in sort of like the pre-legal action correspondence and the sort of disruption to your business. So, you know, whilst a lot of these restriction cases never actually make it to court, an awful lot of time and money is spent toing and froing, you know, arguing, lawyers arguing. I mean, it's all down to us, isn't it? Essentially, we're the only ones who benefit from that. But an awful lot of time is spent arguing about whether they're enforceable, what can be done. And in the meantime, that employee that you've taken on that you expect to be going out and, you know, selling your products or marketing or you know, being your finance director, etc., they're totally distracted and their eye is taken off the ball, because until everything's resolved, they can't do their job properly. So it's the hassle factor as well. That means that it's best to prepare and be warned about the impact of these restrictions. I mean, obviously, if they're blatantly silly, you know, you shall not work for any competitor anywhere in the world for a period of 10 years, then you can go, yeah, okay, we'll take a view on it. But the point is, you've got your eyes on it. You must look at it.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, we can talk about some of the kind of general principles about what might be enforceable and might not be, all the things to be thinking about. The thing about these restrictive covenant cases is that every situation is always different. The context is different, the contract's different, the way that the restrictions are actually worded are different each time. And so it is quite difficult, although there are general themes and precedents to follow. You do need to look at it in the context of your particular scenario. But when we're talking generally about the enforceability of post-termination restrictions, the starting point is usually that they are going to be void. And I think that's why there's this misconception of, well, they're not enforceable, they amount to a restraint of trade. Yes, that is the starting point. You are trying to prevent somebody from working elsewhere. So from a public policy consideration, the courts tend to look at it as they're not going to be enforceable unless, and then we move on to look at the other things. They need to be drafted in a way that go no further than what is absolutely necessary to protect a legitimate business interest. So that's the kind of prism that we're looking through when we're working out the enforceability of the restrictions. Is there another way that the business can be protected? So, for example, can there be more enhanced confidential information obligations within there? But then there's loads and loads of practical points where we see restrictions fall down. So, for example, you might be hiring someone who's been on garden leave for 6 months. Now, if they've got a restricted period for 6 months, you're actually supposed to offset the amount of time they've spent on garden leave from that restricted period. Because the logic is, if you've got someone restricted for 6 months, who's on garden leave for 6 months, in essence, if that was to be enforceable, you'd have someone who was neutralized, for want of a better expression, for 12 months. Instead of being out of the business for 6 months on garden leave, sat at home tending their plants and mowing the lawn. And then for another 6 months after the garden leave ends, which is when employment ends, they're also neutralized as well. So 12-month restriction, which would be unfair. So things to look at are factors like, has that person been on garden leave? If so, is the garden leave period offset against the period of restriction? When were the post-termination restrictions entered into? It's really, really common for people to enter into restrictions when they join an employer. They sign the employment contract, you know, just before day one. They get promoted through a business, but the employment contract and the restrictions are never, ever updated. So they don't bear a bare resemblance to the type of work they're doing on exit. So that's an area of weakness. More basic points. Can anybody produce a signed contract that has these restrictions in? There've been a number of cases that have failed because the outgoing employer has been unable to show what the actual agreement between the parties was. You know, the way that we evidence the agreement is producing a signed employment contract. If you can't produce a signed employment contract, how else can you show that the individual employee agreed to be bound under the restrictions contained in it? And that's a really big watch out for you as part of the onboarding process as well. It's something that is easy to overlook, but even easier to capture nowadays with things like DocuSign, where you can get contracts signed electronically rather than getting wet ink contracts. Have you got something that evidences what the relationship is? So all of those things feed into whether or not those restrictions are enforceable. And certainly, I think one of the key messages from this is, if you're in a scenario where someone comes to you and there are some post-termination restrictions, you should be on alert, and your next step needs to be getting in touch with the experts, i.e. us, if I can say that, and having an analysis done or taking some advice on how enforceable we think those restrictions are, so we can help you with a strategy on how to deal with it. Now, the message from us may be, actually, these are probably enforceable, so we've got to come up with a means of trying to placate the outgoing employer. But you know, there's usually a workable solution. Sometimes you can resolve it through undertakings, which are like legal promises, and assurances that we give to the former employer. So, you know, let us come and work for you, and we promise that we won't go after A, B, or C clients. You know, there are ways of trying to negotiate and resolve things, but you just don't want to be in the situation where it's kind of willful ignorance and you're keeping your fingers crossed and just hoping for the best, because that's probably not going to play out very well.
Yeah, I mean, just one thing I wanted to add there as well on a practical point is there are two schools of thought on what to do. Sometimes you can put it back to the candidate and say, have you spoken, you know, you've handed in your notice, have you spoken to your employer about where you're going? Because it may well be that in actual fact, despite what's written in the contract, the employer is okay with the employee moving to you, or maybe okay with the employer moving to you, but as Peter says, giving an undertaking that perhaps for a period of time they agree to not go after the customers, which you then go, well, okay, fine, maybe that's sort of 3 months or whatever, and we can go through our onboarding process. It can be a getting to know the business type process. So there can be that type of discussion before the employee leaves, but there can also be that type of discussion afterwards if the ex-employer comes to you, and that's the part where we can come in and help. But I mean, there's obviously going to be the types of roles which are going to be sort of high risk, anything sort of sales, I would argue, because obviously there's sort of like key account managers, they will have built up business relationships with their customers, which may well be your customers or your prospective customers. And the ex-employer is going to be very keen to protect those relationships. Anybody senior, this is generally the sort of the senior role. So senior leadership, the ones where they are going to be well into the business, having access to all confidential information and sort of like board discussions, that type of thing. For those roles, that might be where a non-compete might actually become enforceable if it can be shown that that is really the only way to protect the ex-employer. So, you know, you might have highly technical roles where they're into the intellectual property or they're into your coding or whatever it is that you need to, you know, that the ex-employer needs to make sure doesn't come across to you, or at least the know-how inside the head of the employee coming to you doesn't get used, which can damage their business. Those are the types, I think, really, which would be high risk. Some companies have blanket restrictions across everything from a junior administrator right up to the top. And, you know, that's where there is a bit more scope to challenge whether or not those are going to be enforceable.
Yeah, I've seen that before where everybody in the business, from the person who sat on reception right up to, you know, somebody who's participating in senior leadership team meetings, has the same set of blanket restrictions within an employment contract. And you question, well, how can it be that that restriction can apply equally to everybody? It just, on a logical basis, it doesn't make sense. I wanted to mention, we've got some questions, by the way, so I'll come on to those in a second. But before I do, I just wanted to mention, like, one of the practical points that you can do to address all of this is make your offer conditional, your offer of employment conditional on an employee having the ability to come and work for you. Now, normally we're thinking of that in terms of immigration permissions. So, you know, you confirm that you've got, there are no immigration restrictions on you being able to take up employment with us, but also from breach of contract point of view, so you can capture it in terms of there are no legal restrictions which prevent you from coming to work for us. Sometimes for more senior contracts, you'll get that in the form of a warranty, which again is a bit like a legal promise. So there's a warranty from the employee that they're not aware of any restrictions which apply to them, which will prevent them from taking up employment with you. So there are things that you can weave into your employment contract if the role itself warrants it. And as Adrian said at the outset, you know, just having a discussion with the prospective employee and speaking to them about it as a means of flushing out whether or not they're aware of any restrictions, because it's actually not uncommon for individuals to come to us and we spot that they're restricted because they've not identified it, you know, they've not maybe looked at their employment contract for 10 or 15 years. Or another common scenario is that people don't have restrictions within the actual main employment contract, but it's covered off in like a long-term equity plan or, you know, some other document that, again, hasn't been looked at for a while, but actually has a set of restrictions in. You find this with more senior staff, you know, they might be part of an equity plan. And as part of parcel of that process, there are some restrictions in there.
I'm just going to chuck in another or. Because you know, you've gone two ors, I'm going to chuck in another or. Also, you get a lot of employees who are under the misapprehension that if they've been made redundant, then their restrictions aren't going to apply because they take the view, well, the company doesn't need me. Company doesn't need me, so why are they bothered about restricting me? It doesn't matter. It's really only where the employer, the ex-employer, has massively breached the contract, given the employee a constructive dismissal argument, that the restrictions are likely to fall away. So it doesn't really matter how the employment relationship has come to an end, whether it's redundancy or whether the employee has simply resigned to move on. Those restrictions are still potentially in place, and that's something that employees forget.
And I think that reinforces why it's really contract specific in terms of enforceability, and why you kind of need to take advice at the time, because things like, if there is a constructive dismissal argument, then the restrictions may fall away, but you need somebody to analyse whether or not that's a likely claim or not. We've got some questions, so let me just open up the Q&A tab. So the first question is, what if the term is unreasonable? Can these be overlooked? The short answer is yes. If they're unreasonable restrictions, they're not going to be enforceable, and so you're not going to be liable for a breach of contract because the individual's actions wouldn't amount to a breach of contract. I don't know if there's anything you want to add to that, Adrian.
Well, I was just going to say it's not so much that they can be overlooked, because they still need to be assessed. So it still goes back to the point of look at the restrictions, and if they're, I think I gave the example of a non-compete that lasts for 10 years. That's seriously going to be unenforceable. So you can ignore that, but it's, you still have to go through that assessment process really to see whether or not they are capable of enforcement. And what's reasonable is always down to setting that in context of the business where the employee has come from.
Okay. And this is more of a comment than a question, which is quite interesting, actually. Somebody says, I work for a large multinational. As a matter of course, they used to interview competitor employees, regardless of whether they had any openings, just to try and get an insight into their competitor's business, which I quite like the strategy there. I suppose it's a risk for the actual employees who are being interviewed. They've got to be careful not to be giving away confidential information, even if it's the context of a job interview, because the obligations and duties regarding confidentiality still apply to them. So a bit of a sneaky tactic. And then, do any restraints need to be in writing, or can a verbal contract apply to such cases? Adrienne, what do you think about that?
There needs to be evidence of the restriction. So I would say yes, absolutely, they need to be in writing, because it's a contractual term. And while we know that you can have a verbal contract of employment, it's very difficult to evidence if it's not in writing. And there's various other things as well, like, there needs to be consideration for that contract. Now, if it's just been said, what's the context in which it's been said? If somebody comes to you and says, oh, I've been told that, I wouldn't really be worried about that too much, especially if they've got a written contract of employment. Because if they come to you and say, here's my written contract of employment and there are no restrictions in it, and then they went, oh, and by the way, my manager's told me this, I'd be like, yeah, whatever, because they're never going to be able to prove it and make that stand up in court. It comes back to the point where, prima facie, these restrictions are void, and a judge is not that keen on restricting an employee's choice of employer. So the judge would probably say to the ex-employer, if they were that important, why are they not in writing? So it can't be that important to you. So I wouldn't really be too concerned about that.
Yeah, I mean, especially if you think that, like I said before, cases have fallen down because an employer trying to rely on the restrictions and enforce those restrictions hasn't been able to produce a signed employment contract. So in those situations, the restrictions are actually down in writing, but you're not able to evidence that the employee agreed to the restrictions in the first place. So if you've got something that's expressed as being a verbal restriction, you're not going to be able to prove that was all agreed if the employee says, no, I never agreed to that. You haven't got anything to fall back on. So, absolutely, written is the way to go. And then another question, which is, if you become aware of a candidate that has a restricted covenant during the recruiting process and decide not to progress with them, would they have any claim of discrimination? I suppose any claim whatsoever. Definitely not a discrimination claim, because I think the logic would be, if you saw a restriction that you thought, well, on the face of it, it looks enforceable, so we're not going to be able to hire this person, that's a legitimate reason not to continue with the recruitment process, because why would you put your company in a position where you're in the firing line, unless it's an absolutely business critical role and then you wanted to go about negotiating the fact of the person joining you with their current employer. So I think if you were quite risk averse and it was plainly obvious there was a restriction, and maybe, for example, that the outgoing employer is quite aggressive in terms of their enforcement approach to restrictions, then it isn't going to constitute discrimination of any kind, because there's no protected characteristic under the Equality Act associated with that. So
I'm just going to chuck something in there.
Yeah,
just going to chuck something in there. Two things. First of all, it's all about communication. So if the reason why you're not progressing with their application is because of those restrictions, then make sure that you have that discussion and you confirm it, so you've got the evidence. Because in any claim for discrimination, it's down, one of the things the employer has to do is give a non-discriminatory explanation for what they've done. So if that's the reason, document it. Second of all, be consistent, because whilst on the face of it, that might not be discrimination, and what Peter's saying is right, if you have one female employee whose application is not progressed, on the grounds of these restrictions of discrimination. So it's having that consistency approach. I mean, I think it's highly unlikely that's going to happen. And I think it's highly unlikely that a claim would succeed. But it comes back to the point that you don't want to get embroiled in all this legal stuff if you can possibly avoid it. Because even if it doesn't end up in a successful claim against you, it's still taken up time and money.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, can you hear me okay, Adrienne? I just got a message saying my internet connection was unstable. So I guess
no,
I'm
it's fine.
I'm still in the room.
Yeah.
So to summarise it, I think if you're in a scenario where you are taking somebody on, you're aware that there's some restrictions, maybe you've had a letter from another party representing the outgoing employer to say that you're inducing a breach or to warn you off. What we're talking about here is the risk of an inducement of breach of contract claim. That's what we commonly see. The key things to look at are, is there a breach of contract by the employee, or is there likely to be a breach of contract in them joining you? Have you induced or have you incited the employee to act in breach of contract? And did you intend for the employee to breach their contract, or are you indifferent to it? And if the answer is yes to all of those questions, then you are potentially in trouble. Our advice is go ahead and try and get hold of a copy of the contract, or in particular those restrictions, because then you can get that accurate assessment of both the legal risks associated with hiring somebody and also the commercial risks associated with hiring somebody as well. So that's going to help you inform whether you're going to go ahead with the recruitment and what your general strategy should be. Also, if you are into the realms, and hopefully you don't get this far, of actually having legal proceedings threatened against you, you've got to think tactically. You've got to think about whether or not you've got to get separate legal representation for the person that's looking to join you. And that's quite a common scenario. And I'd say most times you will, because there may well be a conflict of interest between what you say has happened and what the individual says as well. But I think—
Peter, I'm just gonna stop you there because you cut out a bit. So for those of you who didn't hear what Peter was saying, separate legal representation for the employee and for you.
Yeah,
sorry.
That's it. Anything else that you wanted to add, Adrienne, before we wrap up?
No, I don't think so. No,
that makes it easy. Thank you so much for joining us, everybody. Thanks for the comments and questions as well. They're always welcome. Next week we're having a look at the employment contract process, obviously continuing with this theme of recruitment. Like I said at the outset, recordings will go on to our website early next week, and the audio recording will be available as well. Please do spread the word about these sessions. They're free for people to join. If you can give us any feedback, if you say anything nice about us on LinkedIn as well, that's always appreciated. So thank you for the plugs people have been giving, and enjoy the rest of your week, and we will tune in and see you all next Thursday. So thanks very much.
Thank you. Bye, everyone.